Okay, let's call the meeting to order. This is the August 22nd, 2022 Clallam PUD Commission meeting, and of course we're virtual. So we'll start off with comments from the public. T, can you see if there's any comments?
Yes, if anyone has a comment at this time, please raise your hand or state your name.
Guess we don't have any.
I see no raised hands.
Okay, agenda revisions. Sean, do we have any revisions?
Yeah, we do. So item 5B under business items, the 2022 resource plan.
Yeah.
The resource plan that's in your packet is actually not valid. We got some comments back from Department of Commerce that asked us to change something. So when we go over that, Tyler will bring it up on his screen and show you the correct resource plan to adopt. So the one in the packet is not valid.
So that's revised. Okay, good.
Yep.
Anything else?
That's it.
Okay, thank you. All right, that's agenda revisions. Approval of consent agenda. We've only got three items. Do we have, these were sent out earlier. Everybody said the commissioners have had a chance to review these. If there's questions or comments, or approval, let's have a motion.
I move that we accept the consent agenda.
I second the motion.
It's been moved and seconded for approval of the consent agenda for August 22nd, 2022. All in favor? Aye.
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 So we have approval. So moving on to business items, our first item is PUD internship presentation on solar storage. Titan, are you there? Yeah, I see you there.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Okay, let me share my screen real fast.
If you don't mind, Commissioner, I'll just give a little introduction here.
Yeah, that's great.
Of Titan. So Titan, this is actually his second summer working as our intern in engineering. The first summer, he brought you a presentation on a solar system that he designed. And he went through the full design, bill of materials, technology review. And so this summer, we had him kind of take it to the next level, and he learned about microgrids and kind of how they work. And he used a certain microgrid software to come up with a design and work through that. And he went through and did a technology review. So he's going to kind of go over the stuff that he kind of learned through his summer internship here and what he got out of being here at Clallam PUD. And just his background, he's actually, his degrees in mechanical engineering with a subset in energy is what he's working on. And he'll actually be, this is his final year with us, and he'll be hopefully graduating next spring and on to bigger and better things. So,
okay.
Titan, go ahead.
So, okay. Titan, are you part of the Energy Northwest intern program, or?
Yes, I am part of the Public Power Internship Program.
So. Great. Well, good. Thank you. Go ahead.
All right. And I'm just going to say this in advance. I'm sorry if you guys hear any background noise in my microphone. I have to open my windows and doors. I just got down to Arizona. My air conditioning unit was broken. So if there's any outside noise, I apologize. That's the only way I'm keeping my house remotely cool.
Okay. That's understandable. Go ahead.
Okay. And present. There we go. Ooh. Cool. So another thing in advance, I was going through my presentation earlier today, and I noticed some of my animations didn't quite work. So some slides will have animations and other slides won't. That was not intended, but it was sadly just what it came out to be. So, well, my name is Titan Burson, and like Colin said, I worked on a storage system for the SWIM solar site in SWIM. It was a really interesting topic, and I'd like to present what I found. So, first off, what is energy storage? Well, it's the process of storing energy, partially, right? The part with energy storage is that we're trying to store excess energy that we're not using currently. So if there's any excess energy on the grid that's not being used, in technical terms, it's being wasted if there's no use for it and it's just being dissipated into heat. So we would like to store this energy, and we can store it in multiple forms, such as pumped hydro and car batteries. Well, in a practical case, we won't be using car batteries, but it's just a picture of a battery. So why should you care? Washington State Clean Energy Transformation Act is in the process of occurring, if not already being instated. And Washington State is trying to reduce all of its carbon emissions and carbon footprints in the near future. And part of that process is pushing for renewable generation and fossil fuel plant shutdown, which is occurring over the course of the next 20, 30 years. We'll have to wait and see how that goes. And with that is a push for more electric use products and appliances. So instead of using propane gas to heat your house, we'd like to use electric-based furnaces. Or instead of using a gas or diesel-based vehicle, we'd like to see electric vehicles instead. So this is a graph from Energy Information Administration, and it just basically shows what our generation is over the last almost 20 years now. And the idea is that you can see that our generation over that time period has changed based off coal generation or natural gas generation. We still depend semi-heavily on fossil fuels, but we are trying to switch to a more renewable energy source, either through solar or through wind. And with that switch, we need to store it, because energy in an alternative sense, or sorry, alternative energy is variable in nature. So we would like to store it for later use when we have excess amount of it. So what kinds of storage are there? There are several different types of storage. There are currently available, and from my research, there are plans of energy storage systems that will hit the market within the next, well, hopefully a couple of decades or so. But a lot of it's still kind of research, and you don't quite know if there will be potential or not. So the currently available ones are pumped hydro, electrochemical, or lithium ion batteries, or flywheel energy storage.
I'm going to mute someone, so sorry about that.
It's all right. Part of the fun of being online. And the next part is the in development or the research energy storage, and that can be compressed air, gravity energy storage, thermal energy storage, or a combination of electrolysis units and fuel cell systems. So the currently available system, one of them is a pumped hydro. So the rough idea of pumped hydro is that when energy is cheap, you can take water from either the ocean, a lake, or some man-made reservoir, and you can pump it up to some higher elevation. And then when electricity is in higher demand or more expensive to charge, you can release that energy or release that water back down through what is referred to as the penstock. It's this kind of tube where a turbine is located in there, and then you will produce energy on the grid when it is needed. The good thing about pumped hydro systems is you can scale them massive in size. Some of them can go all the way up to close to 100 megawatt hours worth of energy. Another one is batteries. Like no different from a TV remote, you can plug in a battery and apply a charge to a system. The only difference is with these batteries is that they are rechargeable. So we can charge them up with excess energy, and then through that storage of energy, when we need it, we can reverse the polarity, and then the charge will, current will go back through the system and power up our grid when we need it. just a standard chemical battery. And the picture that you're seeing right now is the interior of the Sohomish PUD's microgrid system. It's a 1.4 megawatt hour system, which, as you can see, is just a giant, pretty much portable unit of just batteries filled to the brim. The next one that's currently available is the flywheel. Flywheels are these giant rotating metal discs. When you apply energy to them, they'll rotate over time. And the more energy you apply to them, the faster they rotate. When energy is cut off, the disc will keep on spinning, and then it will supply power back to the grid. And as slowly, it will lose energy, making it rotate slower and slower until it stops rotating, and then it will be depleted in energy. These are great for grid inertia, but technically for Clallam County PUD, you guys don't really need to worry about grid inertia. It's more for if we need to balance out wind turbines and solar panels and larger scale systems in the several megawatts scale. So here is the head scratcher one. This is the possible future energy. Currently, there are two commercial units available. Well, I don't want to say available, but that have been installed. There is one unit in the compressed air system that is located in Alabama, and there's another one located in the Germany region, in Germany. And the idea is that you can store air either in underground caverns or in underground tanks, and then when you need energy, you can release that compressed air, and it'll spin up a turbine and then put power on the grid. Again, similar idea as pumped hydro, where you just release it when it's cost-effective to do so. The only issue is sometimes you need to be in areas that have caverns. So they've been looking into another research where you can store it in underwater pockets instead. So one possibility for Clallam County would be looking into the Straits for the Puget Sound, where there's a possibility of storing it either off the coast in the Pacific or somewhere in the waterways. But again, that's just been research. There's not been any commercial installations yet. Another possible storage is a gravity energy storage. Again, similar to pumped hydro. The only difference is instead of flowing water, we're going to be moving either a solid block mass like concrete or like a giant bucket full of sand to different elevations. And with that process, again, when it's cheap, when you raise it to an elevation, when energy is cheap, and then you slowly roll it back down when electricity is higher in demand. So a utility company will receive a profit from that. Again, there's no commercial units available for this. It's purely research and development. The next one is a thermal storage unit. This idea is a little bit interesting. I know I've probably been saying interesting now for like the last three slides, but this one is probably the biggest head scratcher. The idea is that when you have like a boiler plant, let's say, and you have a bunch of excess steam, you can then use that steam and store it into a different storage tank that can contain, say, sand or some sort of like clay material. And then with that heat stored on there, you can then release that energy back onto the grid when you need it. But it's typically only seen in more industrial applications, not so much for power generation, but there has been research into looking into electricity storage on it. And then the last one is a fuel cell electrolysis combination. The idea of this guy is that when you have excess energy, say through solar or wind, you can power up an electrolysis unit that will split distilled water, H2O, into hydrogen or H2 gas and an O2 gas. And then you'll store that H2 gas in an off-site storage tank. And then when you need energy, you can feed that hydrogen gas into a fuel cell. And that fuel cell will produce electricity for the grid. There is a lot of issues with these units. One of the big issues that they are currently coming across is the efficiency of the unit. Currently, the electrolysis unit will use anywhere up to 10 times the amount of energy you will produce from a fuel cell. So right now it's trying to figure out how to increase the efficiency of the electrolysis unit while seeing if there's a way to increase production rates of the fuel cell and power-wise. But it's still research and development at this time. So with the SWIM sub-microgrid, I went for the most applicable option, and that would be with batteries. So we want to supply the SWIM sub-communications hut with power. Now, this communications hut is connected to our SCADA monitoring system and also supports all the internet service providers throughout Clown County. Currently, I have it modeled as the solar system as 32.4 kilowatt hours, or not hours, sorry, kilowatts, and the system could become islanded, meaning that in the event of an earthquake or a major storm and the power lines get disconnected to that communications hut, we can still supply power directly to that communications hut, and we won't have to worry about having a lineman go out there and reattach several lines in hopes to get the building back online before we can get any other work done throughout the county. And again, this is just a more worded definition of islanded mode. And again, for any cascade events, such as a major earthquake or, I don't know, if we get hit by a tornado or something, hopefully that doesn't happen, but who knows now. So, with a block diagram, I just wanted to draw like a rough kind of sketch on how all this wiring will work, will look. And I'm not sure if you're able to see my mouse or not, but the idea is that a microgrid controller will control how the islanded system will decide on how to divert power, either through the EV charging stands on site or to the communications hut, and then it can also act as a controller on when power needs to be taken from the solar panels and then into the batteries, or just put straight into the communications hut. Or in the off chance we just want to put it directly into the grid, the microgrid controller will also control that. Currently, as it's set, the only thing at the SWIM solar site is the PV system, photovoltaic solar arrays, the inverter, and it's hooked directly to the grid. So right now we only see about three of the several blocks currently attached. So with model specifications, I decided to go with a lithium-ion battery, lithium-ion ferrous batteries. These batteries are a lot more heavier duty than your standard TV remote battery, where they can be about 4 feet by, I believe, 6 feet in length and width. These guys are packing high voltage up in the 51 volts, and they can store individually 9.22 kilowatt hours worth of energy on them. So with the system in mind, from what Homer was giving me as numbers, I calculated it was around 100 kilowatt hours we needed for the SWIM communications hut to be completely islanded in a worst case event. So for a day's worth of energy, it would need about 108 kilowatt hours worth of battery life, which it ends up becoming about 12 batteries of storage, or 12 batteries needed. And yes, yeah, so I made, there's two models that you'll see. The first model is going to be the calculations of the system without any batteries, and the second model is going to be with batteries. So here's the model's performance with no batteries. This is what we're currently having, and I've taken data directly from the SWIM solar site. So from the months July and December, which is July was the peak energy performance month of the SWIM solar site, so that's the most amount of energy in that, or sorry, July was the month that produced the most amount of energy throughout the entire month out of the entire 12-month period, and December was the vast or least producing month out of the entire 12-month period. So with that in mind, we had about yearly averages of let me move my mic, it's blocking my way. We had a amount of grid purchases, yearly grid purchases of 11,960 kilowatt hours a year, and grid sales about 20,418 kilowatt hours a year is roughly what the SWIM subsite is. And that would be if we're saying how much energy we're pulling to power up the communications hut versus how much energy we're selling to the grid from the SWIM solar panels alone. Now, this is the model's performance if we were to put batteries on it. So, again, going off of July and December being the max and the minimum, the grid purchases was reduced to 3,479 kilowatt hours a year. And then our grid sales, it reduced to 11,765 kilowatt hours a year. But that makes sense in that we are consuming more energy because we are taking all the potential energy generated through the panels and we're storing it on batteries versus what it currently is, where we're just taking all the energy and dumping it straight into the grid. So by that stance alone, we will produce less energy for sale. That's going to go straight to the grid. So here's a overhead CAD design. I didn't mean for it to be a little confusing if that's what it might look like, but it's just a top-down view on what a possible layout could be. So we're going to need some low-voltage switchgear. Luckily, there is enough space at the old decommissioned SWIM substation where there should be plenty enough room for a battery hut along with a microgrid controller and an inverter setup along with the low gear or low voltage switch gear we're going to need attached to it. All the other components are already there. The solar panels are already there. The communications hut's already there, and the EV charging points are already there too. So the only major installations are going to be the battery storage room, the switch gear, and any underground conduit we need for attaching communications along with power distribution. So the estimated cost for the entire system will be about $276,420.33. The most cost-worthy component would be the microgrid controller itself. These units tend to be specialized, and you have to get them specially ordered. And with today's current market, with how delayed transformers and anything high power production components are for delay-wise, it's just amping up the cost rate. And after that is going to be labor and along with the switchgear components. So that's what the majority of the costs were. All the other costs were relatively lower and possibly could be supplied through PUD's own personal warehouse stock if need be. And just as a wrap-up slide, just a little bit about what I did over the internship. So compared to the last internship I had with Clallam County PUD last summer, I feel like I did a lot more this internship than I did last internship with a lot less time, since I didn't start till late June, where last internship I started about late May and ended around the same time. It was fun to research all the energy storage systems that Clallam County could possibly look into down the line, and it was interesting to learn how Homer software works. And I also enjoyed getting to work with more SCADA systems, modeling all the substations and the main system database. It was really fun to sit back in the room, in the dispatch room, and model everything and see what broke and how to fix it and then how to refix broken stuff and then refix it again. It was pretty fun. And then also my internship was supported by the Public Power Internship Program through Energy Northwest. Any questions?
Any questions for Titan?
I didn't mean to unload a whole bunch of data at you guys in a small period of time.
No, I think your presentation was great. I enjoyed that. That was great.
Thank you.
No questions? I got a question. What's the footprint and how many batteries did you consider putting in there? You said they were 4x6. That's pretty large.
Yes. Yeah, so the overall building, roughly, so the issue with the lithium ion ferrous batteries is they are pretty large, and in some cases they can be almost the size of a refrigerator in just size alone. However, in room-wise, if we were only going to be using 12 batteries, you could be looking at a hut maybe the size of, you know, you could probably put it in a 20 by 20 house or a 20 by 30 room, along with all the other components you need, such as the inverter and the microgrid controller, where those units don't typically take up as much space. But again, going back to, I want to go to the Snohomish PUD unit right here. So this picture right here, again, taken on the outside, and I got a chance to actually tour this facility with Colin during my internship. And Colin could even agree with me that that room is probably about, oh, at least 20 by 15 feet in width and length, and in height, easily probably 20 feet tall. And that thing is just stacked to the brim with batteries.
Yeah, so, that unit would be more than 10 times. And with the way they have the design, it's probably more than 10 times the size of ours.
Yeah. The only difference...
with ours, our larger batteries... because you don't necessarily need cooling. It depends on the chemistry you pick for how dense of a kind of building you put them in. The ones we were looking at are actually, they're heavier, they're much bigger, but they don't require cooling, and they have a much lower occurrence of fire. So, yeah, what he's talking about, you probably have a 400-square-foot building. Hot will take care of them.
And with this technology, the batteries that you're proposing, what's the life of those batteries? I know it's dependent on cycle, number of cycles.
Yeah, so those units, I think they were, what you were looking at, were they 5,000 cycle units, Titan?
Roughly 5,000 cycles. Yeah. So if you're lucky, you're probably pulling about 12 years out of it.
Yeah.
So they change based on the battery. Of course, you know, you can't just compare battery to battery because one battery might die before the other one just through manufacture process alone. But if I had to guess, we're looking at roughly about anywhere from 10 to 12 years on an individual battery basis. The other issue when it comes to large-scale battery storage systems, especially what Snohomish PUD did, is they had to design their system with a bunch of fire suppression system software because these batteries, they're a little unknown in the sense on if they can explode or not. So they had to install a bunch of equipment for firefighter safety. And that was one of their big issues is with the amount of fire suppression systems inside that room. It took up a lot of the costs for building that structure. I remember Scott Gibson, the head manager of this microgrid project, he said that they have, like, I think three or four different fire suppression systems alone for the battery room itself. And again, that's just coming down to the types of batteries and how Snohomish PUD decided that they wanted to install that system. When I modeled the building, I did not take account for fire suppression systems because the batteries that we were looking at, they can operate at much larger temperature differences compared to the Snohomish PUD batteries. So the odds of a fire are significantly less. And also in the event of a fire or installation process, I guess you could say, the contractors will decide on if it is deemable for the system size to install fire suppression equipment versus just have the firefighters not go anywhere near it and just blast it with water from 50 feet away.
So would they use Halon or?
They use a combination. I think they use Halon and they also use water suppressant.
Really?
I think there was a third kind of suppressant they also included in there.
The fire regulations are changing in real time, and within next year there may be some new requirements. But yeah, they use Halon for Halon is for if the electronics burn.
Yeah.
But if the lithium starts on fire, the Halon won't last long enough, and you just need water then. And they what we're hearing about is basically you douse it with water just to keep it cool until the lithium is burned up, which could take, and a unit like that, it could take 20 hours or something like that, let's say, at least a day of just dousing it with water constantly, keeping it cool as it smolders. And then even after that, when they think it's out, putting the units in a tank of water.
Wow.
That's what they have to do with Teslas. That's what they're doing with Teslas right now when they catch on fire. This is the fire department was telling us. They'll come up with a truck with like a giant dumpster that's filled with water, and they'll put the car in the dumpster.
Yeah, that's what the Dutch fire department was doing, I guess, is they have like a contract with a local towing agency, and what they do is they just have these giant garbage bins that they just put the electric vehicles in after they catch on fire, and they just let it sit in water for like a week.
And the owner stands there and cries $100,000.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. That was very interesting. Any more questions or comments? Thank you very much. That was great.
Yeah, well, I do.
Sure.
Maybe Colin, when you went through the numbers, were we looking, so you gave us a cost. Are we looking at this as strictly a resiliency, or does this have a benefit cost ratio that is good for the PUD? We'd want to do it because it makes us a little money or what?
We haven't gotten into that side of things. This is really just a simple kind of a bill of materials cost. So, no, it hasn't factored in any potential other benefits that, could be considered.
When I was calculating the cost per kilowatt hour, since that's how you rate energy storage systems, a little different from a price per kilowatt hour or price per kilowatt. The problem with energy storage systems is that batteries, they decay a lot faster than, say, a solar panel does. And it's almost impossible to model an entire system in a simple cost analysis. It's more like you have to model every individual battery as it degrades over time. So there's a lot of assumptions at play on the cost per kilowatt hour. And the other issue is when it comes to energy storage systems, for what we're trying to do, it's not really so much as a cost-effective base for the customer. It'd be more for a redundancy in the event of a natural disaster for Clown County PUD side. But again, not so much.
Well, there's other benefits that could be considered too.
That's
potential, peak shaving or other ancillary services.
Yeah.
So it's peak shaving, resiliency. Okay.
We didn't get into those details. I was just trying to keep it simple. What would it cost to install this? The first cost.
This is John. So basically, if we were to proceed with a project like this, it would be in the context of resiliency associated with critical communications infrastructure. And we would very much be looking at predominant grant funding.
Yeah.
Would we... I don't know that we have good examples here, but would this be something like if we had a hospital or something that was a customer and our choice was you could do generators for emergency backups or batteries? This is the kind of thing we would look at in a cost analysis to determine whether if we've got certain customers with critical power requirements like a hospital or maybe an elder center or even a grocery store, This is the kind of analysis or system we would look at and say, what is this a good way to achieve resiliency on these critical key infrastructure items?
Yes, absolutely. So basically, we have a lot of customers who are interested in microgrids. There's a lot of grant funding available, and it would be beneficial for this type of project or another project we're actually working on with PNNL, that we might be able to migrate the information we learn on one project to more expansive projects or many different projects throughout the peninsula.
Yeah, good. I just mentioned it now because, I met with the Macaw Tribal Council a week before last, just talk about all the things the PUD was doing and so forth. And this still is something that's high on their agenda. It's kind of a comprehensive look at all the different kind of issues that relate to power directly or indirectly, and look at the emerging technologies, especially batteries, and see what role they could play in building more resiliency, not maybe for the whole NEA Bay Area, but certainly for key infrastructure items to get started. So I would hope that we would take this kind of exploratory investigation we have here and start looking at specifics where we could apply these things.
something that I just want to tie in because it applies to it is I've been reading a few articles about utility companies across the nation and across a few other countries. And what they're doing is when major companies, let's say Walmart, wants to put like half a megawatt out or half a megawatt's worth of solar panels on their roof, the utility companies will say, okay, we'll let you do that, but you also have to pitch in so much profit for a backup battery system to attach to it to act as a grid redundancy for their system. So some utility companies, when it comes to large enough infrastructure systems, they will mandate that these companies need to, if they want to do self-generation, that they have to attach so much energy storage before they can hook up to the grid as a secondary backup system in the worst case scenario.
Well, this battery technology, what's the history on it? Is it new technology or is it?
I'd say probably within the last 10 years, that's probably when we've seen the most explosion in the development market, especially with the Snohomish PUD's recent microgrid setup, which is,
it's a specific battery that you're proposing. What's the history?
The one we're looking at, it actually has been around much longer than the newer lithium chemistries.
Oh, really?
It's all about the chemistries, and they've all been evolving a lot. The lithium iron with the iron in it is a, you said, it ends up being, the downside is it's larger and heavier, but the plus side is it's much more reliable. So these batteries have been out, they've been an option for RVs and other equipment in various places for many years. I don't know how far back it goes, but it's much older than your new cobalt or magnesium design.
Vanadium flow or anything.
Yeah, exactly.
I've also heard recently, I think some islands in Hawaii have been using lithium ion ferrous batteries again to act as a more resilient source of energy storage versus lithium ions because of the typically high temperature climate that Hawaii is in. So it's easier to have batteries work more efficiently. Like the lithium ferrous batteries work more efficient in the warmer temperatures versus lithium ion batteries, just through chemistry alone.
Okay, well, thank you very much. That was very interesting.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks. Okay, our next item is the 2022 resource plan. Tyler, are you there?
Yes, Will, thank you.
Okay, fantastic. Tyler, go ahead.
Okay, the resource plan is a requirement under RCW 19.280, House Bill 2006-1010. And as you can see, can scroll up a little bit on the spreadsheet. Okay, thank you.
There we go.
This shows a base year 2020, 5-year forecast and a 10-year forecast. We are expecting most load growth to be countered with conservation, and this is based on our conservation potential assessment. One change that we were asked to do from the Department of Commerce, in the 5-year and 10-year period, we were expecting to initiate demand response. And we input this on line 12. And the Department of Commerce wants only resources targeted towards lowering demand. Example, like a gas peaker plant. What we were thinking of was load shifting. We were thinking heat pump water heaters that are able to be controlled and shut off at certain times when there's peak demand. In order to do this, the customer would have to have a heat pump water heater and a smart meter. And the Department of Commerce recommended that we include that information in the notes at the bottom of the resource plan. Also of requirement is that the resource plan that this comes out every 2 years, it needs to be approved by the commission. So this does need board approval. Is there any comments?
Yeah, I'm a little confused by that demand response thing. You know, that's looked on as having a lot of potential. I know out here we're mainly, of course, we're almost all residential, so it'd have to be hot water heaters and things like that. But so you're saying they didn't want us to claim anything there, is that right?
They wanted just resources. So if we had some other type of generating resource that could kick on during times of peak demand, that would be included under the under resources. But if it's just load shifting, for example, like in the past presentation, like batteries, they would just include that in the notes at the bottom.
Okay. So you're looking for a motion on this one?
Yes, sir.
So do we have I don't see a motion number.
I'm looking for a board approval that just needs to be noted in the notes. I'm sorry.
Okay, so we have a motion to approve this, and then we can just vote on it. How's that?
Yeah, I mean, it looks good to me. I mean, it's not a whole lot here, just basically our loads, and so that's all we're telling them, and yeah, I'm fine with it.
Okay, good. Rick, are you?
I guess I don't quite understand.
Yeah, so this is something we have to file, and so we just have to, the commission has to approve it.
I know, but I don't understand, you know, where did the, I'm assuming that we had some numbers under demand response, and now we've blanked them out, so what did we do to compensate? Just put the note at the bottom?
Yes. Yes.
I guess.
Yes. Okay.
Well, they kind of, we have to dance to their music, so I guess we just have to do that. So what do you say, Rick? Are you comfortable with this? I guess it's just a matter of filing the information that they're asking for, so I guess I'm comfortable with it.
I guess I'm okay.
Okay, so we'll call that approval. Is that sufficient for your purposes, Tyler?
Yes, well, thank you.
Okay, great. All right, thank you very much. Okay, our next one is Resolution 2247-22, authorizing disposal of surplus property. Steve, you're always disposing of surplus property, so go ahead.
I'm always throwing junk away.
Yeah. We hope it's junk.
Well, it is junk. I mean,
yeah, I know. I'm being facetious.
I know you are. So the equipment listed below has little or no value to meet the current business needs of the district. Therefore, it's recommended that this equipment be declared surplus. And I had to put a dollar value on all of these items, and you see some of them have some pretty significant amounts, $800, $1,000, $450. Even though these are numbers that I got off of, you know, looking at similar pieces of equipment on the internet. But the ones that we're proposing that we dispose of, these ones that actually have dollar amounts to, this equipment is worn out or it has so many failed parts that it really isn't worth even what I've quoted here. So if there's any questions about some of these, otherwise asking for approval of this resolution to dispose of this equipment.
So probably this will go to recycling or?
Yes, it'll go to recycling.
Okay. Okay, do we have a motion?
I move that we accept resolution 2247-22 authorizing disposal of surplus inventory.
I second.
It's been moved and seconded.
Motion. Yeah.
Been moved and seconded to approve resolution 2247-22 authorizing disposal of surplus property. All those in favor?
Uh-huh.
Aye. Okay. Thank you, Steve. Okay, our next item is acceptance memo for agreement cost increase for bid number 220805, the Fork Substation Construction. Doug?
Hello. Okay, I am requesting to approve the memo to both increase the cost on bid 210804 as well as extend the contract date. Previously, the contract date was September 1st for the not to exceed, and due to shipping delays on the control house, we're not able to complete our work, and we're not expecting to receive that control house until the first week of September. So with having to close down construction and then restart construction, that's going to cost us an extra $8,672.40, as well as extend the potential completion date to September 29th.
So I see this is the fourth, this will be the fourth change orders. Do we think that's the end of it, or do we think we're going to see more on this?
That should be it, because this is like the last piece of the puzzle here.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Because it seems like at the last board meeting, didn't we do something very similar to this for the Fork substation?
We didn't have any material delays at that point. The last one was approving an upgrade to essentially the underground drain system to remove excess water from the site. And that was a failed drain system that we had not foreseen.
So this is not supply chain related or whatever, is it?
This particular one is supply chain related.
Yeah. Okay, do we have a motion on this one? This is an ongoing story. We're going to see more of this, I suspect, but not on this project, but we'll see it elsewhere.
I don't have any issues, but I don't have the resolution statement in front of me to read.
I move that we accept memo for agreement cost increase for bid number 220805, Fork Substation Construction.
Mine says 804. Oh, I see. It's 805 on one document, 804 on another, which is correct. Yeah, I guess it's 805. Okay.
All right, I second the motion. Thanks, Rick.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded for approval of an increase of bid number 210804 in the amount of $8,672.40. All those in favor?
I think that should be the wrong. You had the wrong number there. You did the four again.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I got to cross that out. The one sheet says four and one says five. Okay, so let me restate that. So moved and seconded for approval of a agreement for cost increase, a memo for agreement of a cost increase for bid number 210805. All those in
still the wrong number.
Hold on, Will. I show on the board packet it says 220805.
Okay.
Is that right, Doug? 220805?
I think that's the correct number.
That's what's on the agenda.
Yeah, mine says 210804, so let me just scribble all that out so we'll get the – I'll go to this this attachment. So, okay, let me restate that, and I'll assume that that's what you used, Rick, right?
Yes, sir, the 220805.
Okay, so it's been moved and seconded for approval of a memo for agreement for a cost increase for bid number 220805. All those in favor?
Aye.
We finally got it right. I just read the script that's in front of me. So anyway. Okay, moving on. Draft memo of understanding MOU between the county and the PUD for the Carlsberg water supply. This is for discussion only. Tom?
Good afternoon, commissioners. So this is a memorandum of understanding of the interests of both the district and of Clallam County.
Can I ask a question before you even start, Tom? Sorry.
Yeah.
There used to be a Carlsberg citizen group which was following all this, and I've gone to some of their meetings back when this was very active. Are they aware of this memo of understanding with the county and what's going on here?
The group that I was involved with back when the sewer was being planned.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Stayed together for a little bit longer after this, basically Ecology approved the facility plan in 2014. And then it kind of dissolved after a while. I haven't heard any activity of that citizens committee for years. So I don't know if they've been informed, the former members.
Yeah, well, just the whole customer base, I guess, is what I would be concerned about. But go ahead. We'll talk about this. It's just for discussion anyway, so that's good.
Okay. It includes the interests of both the district and the county. And so I tried to represent our districts based on our mission statement and the commissioner's policy that was informally adopted in the 1990s regarding the expansion of the service area, you know, requiring water rates first before we expand. And we formally adopted that into a policy in 2017. And we've been acting under that formal policy since then. So what the document is, or it's intended to be, with all the interests laid out as individual interests for both parties and our mutual interests, this is an effective way for groups to solve problems. And it's by beginning with sharing their individual interests. So we agreed on a set of mutual interests to use to generate solutions or positions that take these set of interests into account. So this is all leading towards a legally binding interlocal agreement between the district and the county that would have greater details for a solution that meets as many as our mutual interests as possible. So this MOU is just an understanding of interest. It is not binding legally in any way. So the draft final MOU was included in your in your packet for this week. And I'm really here to, you know, answer any questions or elaborate more on different aspects of it per your request.
So is this just formalizing the agreements we've had with the county? And again, it's an MOU, it's non-binding. Anything new in here that beyond what we've talked about before?
No, we've talked about this a fair amount. We just wanted to get it clear. I've been working with Steve Gray on this, and, I think that as you read through it, you can see a lot of the same issues that we've been dealing with. The county is very interested in having a predictability of water supply in the urban growth area. And that's kind of a new phrase that they've come up with to describe, what they want, along with affordable housing. And then they put in some excerpts from their own comp plan about having water supply provided in an expedient manner. So they were very interested in putting in a comment that ecology had regarding, how much water of our existing water right we're actually using at this point, 20%. But I also, from our perspective, added some excerpts from the Dungeness watershed plan, which was adopted by the county and the initiating governments, including Jamestown's Phylum Tribe and the Irrigation Interests Water Users Association. And that had to do with public water supply and planning for future. One of the recommendations and desired outcomes of that watershed plan was that water suppliers apply to ecology for full build-out water rights. And that was clearly stated in there. And so that watershed plan actually carries a lot of weight. It's some marching orders. Everybody knows that around here for water supply planning in the Dungeness Basin. And every major water resource inventory area in the state has one or is developing one. And if they don't have one, then ecology writes one for them. And it's been the basis of several large lawsuits going around, and the adjudication effort up in Watford County is all based on their watershed plan. So we have one of our own, and it was really good that while it was being developed, that it was important, the recommendation that all water systems apply for as much water as they need or project to need for a full build out.
So part of that was there was a water bank run by the Water Trust. Is that still in place, and how's that going?
Water bank, Water Trust is still in place. That was created by the 2013 Dungeness River in-stream flow and water management rule.
Yeah.
And so they're an important part of the regional water supply in this area. They're mostly there to serve or enable water to be provided for single-family houses out in rural areas, some five-acre lots.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Tom, my connection I lost for a few moments there during your presentation. I guess the question I have to you is, are you satisfied with this MOU?
Yes, I am. The county listened to what we had to say and understood completely. And that's a breakthrough in and of itself. And the same with me, listening to them and understanding what they are interested in. That was the critical part, is that, you know, we're sharing valid information about our intents or our assumptions. And we're trying to get a free and informed choice that, you know, we can all internally commit to. So we have responsibility now shared between the county and the district in making this happen. And so in that regard, yeah, I think we followed a really good process, a mutual interest-based decision-making process that I'm satisfied with.
Well, good job, John, Tom. The other question I have for you is, I think it was two or three meetings ago that we had a number of people bring this issue up. And I can't recall exactly what their arguments or concerns were. But do you think it will satisfy our members that have a dog in this fight?
Our members that have a dog in this?
Well, that care about this issue is what I mean by that.
Well, yeah, you know, the policy that I was talking, you know, the service area policy has been a longstanding policy. It was informal, set back by the commission in the 1990s, as I mentioned, and we formalized that in 2017. That is looking out for the pioneers of the LUDs, you know, for the folks who paid in to buying those water rights and getting them in the first place and getting the water system built. We're there to preserve their access to that water. So,
thank you, Tom.
Okay.
So, Tom, I thought we had an interlocal agreement with the county that they would assist in getting additional water rights. Is this in lieu of that, or how does that go? How are they related?
Well, they are related. It's the agreement from 2013, the interlocal one that you were talking about, is referenced in this MOU.
Yeah.
And our interest is to preserve that that interlocal agreement. That interlocal agreement, however, leaves a lot of room for, you know, details on how we're going to move forward. And so that's what the county is very much, well, we're both very much interested in clarifying, you know, how are we going to solve this issue with ecology and all the rest of the stakeholders in the basin. So, you know, the county they promised in that interlocal agreement to provide us, to procure us, otherwise obtain water rights to full build-out.
That's what I recall.
Yeah, but, you know, well, who's going to manage the whole process? And who's going to hire the consultant? And, you know, the PUD has a development schedule on, you know, how are we going to use this water right over time with all the different moving parts of this blending system? So there's a lot more detail in there, roles and responsibilities.
And this addressed those details. That's what I'm hearing.
Well, yeah, this will set the stage for coming up with solutions and providing details.
Yeah, something that is actionable. This is just a MOU, non-binding. So,
right. And this document is very important to the Department of Ecology. This is part. You know, ecology has that four-part test for water rights. And the last test is you got to show that this water right is in the public interest. Well, just the fact that, you know, both commissions are going to review and hopefully adopt a final MOU here will demonstrate to Mike Gallagher and the Department of Ecology that there is public interest here. And it really makes a big difference when you got two of the major water interests and water managers in this county coming together and signing an MLU like this, this will go a long way in passing that test.
So this is just for discussion. Are you going to bring this back for approval, or do you need approval?
Well, the next steps are, well, September 12th, there's a joint commission meeting that's being planned between the county and the PUD. So that's our first meeting in September.
Yeah.
And so with any comments that I get from you, I can work with Steve Gray. He's presenting this MOU to his commission today as well. We will get together and make this a final. That's why I'm calling it a draft final. You know, we're waiting for review comments from both sets of commissions. And we'll put it together, come up with a final, and hopefully adopt it on the 12th. Now, in between, the county has informed me that on September 1st, they're having a meeting with the Jamestown Skylum Tribe about this and other issues to have with them. And I'd like to attend that. And maybe, you know, if it's of interest to the commission or a commissioner, you might want to attend that as well.
Okay. So do we need to give you all our comments today, or do we have a bit of time?
We have a bit of time. I have to submit something, you know, the Wednesday before the 12th, whatever date that is, but I would kind of like to have them before that so I could work with Steve to put them into a final document. So that's the 7th of September is the deadline for getting the final back to each of the commissions for their review.
Okay.
It would be nice if I had something on the 31st.
Okay, well, can't speak, but I think we can look this over and get our comments to you. It's unless we have comments now. Everybody happy with that?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Sounds good.
All right, good. All right, thank you, Tom. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
Our next item is BPA post-2028 contract discussion.
I had something real quick, Will, on this, if you don't mind.
Certainly, yeah.
I don't know if any of you looked at the slides from the third quarter of QBR from BPA, but their financial position is actually quite extraordinary right now. They have revenues are exceeding rate case expectations in both power and transmission. And to my knowledge, this is the best that they have ever looked during the entirety of the regional dialogue contract. Right now, they have almost $1.6 billion in reserves, and that's an agency days cash on hand of 243 days, 273 for power. And as you know, BPA's KPIs or anything over 60 is in the green, and this is almost 250. So quite astonishing how good BPA is doing right now in their secondary sales.
But it's not only secondary sales, it's also a very good water year, right? Is that?
Yeah, they so anything over $172 million in net revenue is good. And in the third quarter, they were $836 million. So, I mean, it's quite a banner year for BPA for sure.
Good.
Will, as I understand it, it's all this profit, so to speak, is being made off secondary sales because of the high water. The timing this year was just absolutely perfect. You know, it was early, and we still were, you know, in the winter tail end of the winter peaks, and the prices with natural gas prices driving mid-sea through the ceiling. So it was just a confluence of, you know, rare events, but yeah, it's I think made almost $600 million in secondary sales this year.
Yeah.
So they are above the revenue distribution clause threshold. So it looks like depending on what the administrator decides to do, if everything goes good in the fourth quarter, it looks like we'll get a revenue distribution at some point next year, which could be, you know, upwards of $500,000 to $900,000 a month potentially, based on the numbers that we ran this morning. So if that happened, I mean, that would be like half of our bill almost in the summer months. So it'll be interesting to see how they finish out the fourth quarter, but just based on these preliminary numbers, it's looking quite favorable. Now, the administrator can use the money to pay off debt and do other things, but if they did the whole amount to the utilities, it would be quite substantial.
So the bottom line is Bonneville is not going broke. Is that what, that's what I'm hearing.
Not when they have
$1.6
billion in reserves. That's pretty darn – I've never seen anything like that with them, so this is quite extraordinary.
Okay, good.
It is, but what we have to keep in mind is that you know, Bonneville lost $800 million up until 2019, and Elliot Meinzer made it because it was so bad back then. He deferred a lot of capital expenditures on major end items like turbine rehabs, the Fish and Wildlife Program, hatchery rehabs, all that kind of stuff. And so it looks great, and that's why our, you know, our rates have been relatively flat the last 2 years, and they're talking, and, you know, as discussions roll out for the next rate case, it looks good too. But we still have this massive backlog of capital expenditures that are necessary to keep the system going in the future. And so this is great. And I just hope, and we can't, you know, expect it to last. Just like I said, it's a rare confluence of events. And so, we would hope that they need to spend it in a way that is good for the future. And then, B, we still have to reckon with, okay, what about all these, you know, capital expenses that you've been deferring and so forth?
Of course, they got another $10 billion in borrowing authority as well.
Well, sure. Yeah, but that, you know, that's great as long as you can afford to pay the interest on it.
You're sounding a little cynical.
I am.
Or skeptical. Skeptical.
We need to switch money, but, you know, we're not out of the woods yet by any means. The fact that we're $15 billion in debt. So it's good news, but we shouldn't take our binoculars off the issues here.
Okay, thank you. Anything else, Sean?
Yeah, it looks like we lost Rick again. Will, I don't know if you want to give him a few minutes or.
Okay.
I'm not exactly sure. Oh, looks like he's coming back on.
Where is.
There he is.
Rick, did you miss all that or?
I missed after Jim's comment.
Which one? He's made a number of them.
and I just commented that we could look forward to Jim always finding the negative in anything that has to do with Bonneville.
Okay. All right, good. Any other comments on the 2028 contract post-2028?
No, sir.
Okay, correspondence communications. I see we have Pacific Northwest National Lab Roundtable. Sean, are you going to give us a briefing on that?
I was just going to give an update on kind of the events that transpired for the visit to Pina Nelk here the week before last. So I received I got some notes here, so I'm just going to kind of go through them. I received an invitation to participate in a roundtable with the United States Secretary of Energy Jennifer Granholm regarding collaborations for climate and energy resilience in rural areas. And in your board packet today is a memo that I've put together kind of outlining the format and in the remarks that I personally made to the Secretary. And so prior to the meeting, PNNL staff emailed the participants of the roundtable and asked them, gave them a heads up that said, hey, we would like you to share local challenges for system upgrades and specifically as it relates to rural communities. And you can see how I addressed that specifically in my remarks. So the meeting with the secretary was, it was only 45 minutes long, and it ran from 11:45 to 12:30. And prior to our meeting, she was on a tour of the campus at Pinyon Mountain here in SWIM. And there was a newspaper article last week that kind of went over, that covered that event. That's not something that we were part of. At 11:45, they brought Secretary Granholm into a small conference room on the campus. And there was several minutes of handshaking and personal introductions as she made her way around the room introducing herself. Once we were all seated, the director of PNNL, Stephen Ashby, moderated the meeting. And he started off by thanking the roundtable participants for attending. And there was Secretary Granholm, Ron Allen, and Timothy Green, who are both chairmen for the Jamestown and Macaw tribes, respectively. Derek Kilmer with the U.S. House of Representatives. Jerry Richmond, the undersecretary to Secretary Granholm. Steve Theringer. Some other DOE managers and personnel, plus a representative from the city of SWIM and NODC, and then myself. Mr. Ashby opened the meeting by inviting the secretary to speak, and she primarily focused her discussion on the recent legislation, the Inflation Reduction Act. And she thanked Mr. Kilmer for supporting and was excited for the upcoming vote that was happening on that Friday that would finally send the legislation to the president's desk. And she also talked about the recent CHIPS Act, which seeks to restore U.S. leadership in semiconductor manufacturing, and was hopeful that it would greatly assist the U.S. in some supply chain issue mitigation, such as what we're experiencing with our transformers. So during the secretary's opening remarks, she asked for each roundtable participant to discuss some of the challenges that we're experiencing with regard to energy resilience, and was interested in continued partnerships with local tribes, PNNL, and specifically community stakeholders. There was an around-the-room briefing that ensued where each member was allowed to speak for 2 minutes. And then during the roundtable comments, there were several themes that emerged from the participants. The first was the tribes were asking for a seat at the table with legislation to ensure that their people were not adversely affected by the transition to clean energy. The tribes also indicated that they were interested in opportunities specifically surrounding marine-based generation that PNNL is currently working on. Funding challenges for grants in rural communities has become increasingly difficult. Many local organizations are struggling to compete with larger urban organizations who have dedicated staff for grant writing. And then transmission constraints coupled with reliability for rural communities, including our West End tribes who incur lengthy outages during storm season. However, Chairman Green did comment that over the last few years, the PUD has done an excellent job at curtailing their long outages they used to experience due to our aggressive vegetation management programs. He was very complimentary of the district in those efforts. After each participant was allotted their 2 minutes, Secretary Granholm thanked each person for being there and gave closing remarks. Specifically, she commented to the Jamestown and Macaw tribes that she hears their concerns and thanked them for bringing their challenges to her attention. And then after the secretary exited the conference room, the director of PNNL, Mr. Ashby, he gave a PowerPoint presentation overview of PNNL and the types of technologies that they're working on, specifically related to homeland security, energy, and chemistry, which are their primary funding sources for PNNL. After the tour, or after the presentation, we were invited to tour the campus, and we met with some of the scientists who showcased their work. A couple of the interesting projects that we got to see were they're turning seaweed into jet fuel, and they're also using ocean currents to spin a generator to produce electricity, which is something they're working on out here in the Strait. At the conclusion, we were all thanked for our attendance, and we made contacts with staff members at PNNL to immediately follow up on further collaboration. And then the next day on Thursday, we met with PNNL and discussed specific federal grants and projects associated with the development of a marine-based microgrid framework at the PNL facility. And that letter of support is also in your board packet, the very last page behind my memo. And we stressed to them through personal meetings and correspondence that we are definitely committed to providing an advisory role with the objective of guiding projects to ensure that the outcomes serve our community and provide system data to support the analysis of projects within our distribution network. And PNL staff were very pleased and thankful for our commitment to collaboration and support of their important work. So overall, it was a really exciting opportunity to meet with the secretary, and she was very complimentary of the work that we do and thanked all of us for our attendance. So again, I have a memo in your board packet with my remarks, and so happy to answer any questions about the visit if you have any.
Any questions for Sean? Okay, so thank you, Sean. That was a good summary of the meeting. I believe it was very prescriptive, very structured. So
yeah, all it right. Definitely was. It was a good opportunity, and they have a very impressive staff over there, and we're excited from our perspective to collaborate with PNL about some of the things that they're working on. So if nothing else came out of the meeting, some great contacts were made for future discussions.
Great. That's important.
Yep.
Okay, if no other questions or discussion on that, let's move on to commissioner reports. Jim, you want to lead us off?
Yeah, I mentioned that I paid a visit to the McCaw Tribal Council the week before last, and to listen to what issues they had, concerns, and so forth. And I think they pointed out since my last visits and our discussions we had a couple of years ago with Vince Cook, who by the way has passed on to everyone unexpectedly a couple months ago. Anyway, they were complimentary of our improved service and responsiveness and taking care of power lines and stuff like that. So they're a lot happier than they were a couple of years ago. We also talked about just the whole issue of resiliency and developing alternate power resources and stuff with them, and recognize that the technical complexity of doing that in that part of the country, in the county, and the weather conditions and so forth. And but they're still interested in having some sort of body of decision makers and technical folks start thinking through what some of their mid to long range and short term, I guess, opportunities or to solve some of the challenges they're facing with. And, they have a range of issues out there from, tsunami issues to lack of water, to unreliable power shortage because they're just at the very end of the line and so forth, and just their economic situation in general. So those are all things that somehow we need to get some folks head around and help them with that. The other thing, I attended the WAPAG meeting that had to do with the it was a kind of a training, 1 hour training thing on regional markets and so forth, and listened to a presenter give all that. And I don't know, Rick, were you on that call?
No.
Okay. Yeah, you would know more about this than I would. But anyway, a long presentation on, a regional market and so forth like that, a formal market in Pacific Northwest and so forth. And I guess it really boiled down, they mentioned you have to have a critical mass of PUDs and co-ops and so forth to be able to pull that off. But also the whole thing with Bonneville, already, with 76% of the grid and 37% of the power, it makes doing anything really, I guess, complicated, because how does BPA play into that and so forth like that. So there was no decisions or anything like that. It was just basically information, and nobody had many questions. I think they all just listened and went, yeah, right, okay, next. So anyway, I did that, and I guess that's about it.
Okay, Rick, do you have something?
I didn't attend any meetings, didn't have any scheduled for me, but I would like to note the passing of Dr. Michael McCoy. I was in graduate school in 1984, and my advisor suggested that I take a summer internship with the Bonneville Power Administration. And since I didn't have – actually, since I didn't want to go back to Alaska that summer, I chose to work with Bonneville. And when I got to Bonneville my first day, I was introduced to Michael McCoy. This was in 1984, I believe, somewhere in that area. And Michael had been working at Bonneville for many years, and he had created a model of the power, all the resources and all the loads in the Pacific Northwest. The model was called SAM, the System Analysis Model. My job was to create a sub-routine that modeled intermittent resources. And lo and behold, that's looking at solar and wind projects. And here we are, here I am, 30-something years later, and McCoy's work is really coming into the limelight right now. Michael was probably one of the smartest people I think I'd ever been around, and he always had such a twinkle in his eye that when you were talking to him, you always thought that he was two or three steps ahead of you, and he probably was. The region is definitely worse off with having lost Michael. That's all I've got, Will.
Okay, thank you, Rick. That's a good memorial. Well, we had Energy Northwest Resource Adequacy. The big decision this month was Grant was looking at two technologies for their small modular reactor. They're really on board with building one of these. But they were looking at NuScale, which is the technology out of Oregon State. And that's the project that the first one was going to be over in Idaho, built by UAMPS, and they were looking for subscribers to that project, and they started off at $60 per megawatt hour, and then it got down, they pared that down to about $55. But that project has not, gone ahead. But NuScale has sold their technology, let me back up. They were being financed by the Fluor Corporation in total, and Fluor spun them off, and their stock is on the exchange now. I'm not sure it's NASDAQ or where, but they are an independent company now. But they were selling this technology overseas and building a number of projects overseas, but nothing in the U.S. So anyway, Grant was looking at that, and then the alternate technology was X Energy, and X Energy's technology is the encapsulated nuclear fuel in a graphite ceramic balls, which are fed through the reactor. We learned, and they were going to make that decision this month, and kind of got this clandestinely that they did make the decision, and they're going to go with X Energy rather than NuScale. So that was the technology that Energy Northwest favored and recommended. So that's a good thing. This all comes under the Advanced Nuclear Reactor Program, which Department of Energy is financing. The requirement was that a team of a nuclear operator, which in this case is Energy Northwest, and a utility, which is Grant. So that's another step forward in getting that project done. They have the NRC has to approve sites for nuclear activity, and Grant has come up with three sites so far, and two of those have been rejected by the NRC. So they're still working on that issue, but let's hope we can get all the ducks in a row and get going on that. And the requirement of that agreement with DOE is that the first of a kind would be in operation by 2027. Energy Northwest feels like that may not be doable. It may stretch out to 2028, 2030. Outside of that, I spent a lot of time at the Clallam County Fair, and I guess people were really elated to be out. This is the first time that's been held in 2 or maybe 3 years. It's been a while. And the biggest downside was they ran out of scones. I thought we were going to have a riot there at one time. But anyway, it was fun and interacted with a lot of people, and there was really an upbeat attitude of the whole thing. So that's how I spent my week. Any questions on commissioner reports? Do we have staff reports, Sean?
Nothing today.
Okay, good. So, have we identified some action items, T?
I did not identify any action items this time around, Will. Unless
I
missed
something.
The
only thing would be comments back to Tom Martin on the MOU that he's proposing with the county.
I will note that.
Okay, great. All right, comments from the public. T, do we have any, or can you shepherd that?
Yes, if anyone would like to make a public comment at this time, please raise your hand or state your name. I am seeing no raised hands.
Okay. Well, good. We've got no executive session, so we've got a hand just went up to Christine Reed.
I just wanted to make a quick comment and thank Sean for his representation of us with Senator Granholm, or with this Secretary Granholm. Thank you, Sean.
Yeah, thank you, Christine.
Good. All right. Any other comments or questions from the public? Going once? Okay. So we have no executive session, so if there's no other business to come before the commission, we will adjourn. Thank you to everyone for participating.
Thanks, everybody.